So we're, if you're here for the first time this morning, or if you have a short memory, what we're doing here on Sunday mornings is we're working through the book of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians at the moment. It's our habit here at Thornbury Baptist Church just to work through a Bible book, nothing fancy, nothing clever, but just staying rooted in the Word of God as best we can together and trying to understand what the Scriptures say to us as God's people. If you remember, the context of 1 Corinthians is there's a very new church in a big city, started by the Apostle Paul. Paul has had a letter from this little church in which he's understood some things that were perhaps not working as they might have been, and with some questions to their founding apostle, asking them, what do we do in this situation and in this situation? And this morning we've got to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and it's quite clear from verse 1 that Paul is actually picking up now concerns that they had concerning the matters about which you wrote. And in chapter 7, what he does is he develops a number of fairly short and concise answers to a number of questions that they had asked about their relationships, particularly about their marriages and about their sex lives. Now, I wish as a preacher that they'd asked about their prayer life, because it would make my life much easier. If only they asked about that or how to understand the Old Testament, you know, but they didn't. So here we go. One of the things that is notable, though, in that simple fact that they did ask about that, is how much they'd understood very early in their Christian journey that everything about their lives now needed to be reviewed under their calling to be Christians. There was no sense that there were some things that were just private and personal and the rest was God stuff. They somehow had picked up very quickly that everything, including the most personal and private aspects of their lives, needed to be reviewed under their calling to be Jesus people and members of God's kingdom. And I think even that is an interesting insight as we get going. They were citizens now of a new country. And I don't want to keep picking on you because I don't actually know you, but I'm sure when you went to live in Australia, there were all sorts of new things you had to pick up quickly and had to learn. How do we do this here? How do we fill in that form? How do we, you know, which side of the road do we drive on? There's all sorts of things. When you live in a new country, you have to pick up very quickly. And becoming a Christian is just like that. It's about living in a new country, God's kingdom country. And suddenly you have to ask everything about the way things are done. How do we do this now? How does this work now? And so this morning, in this particular chapter, they're asking about their personal lives, their relationships, their marriages, their sex lives. And Paul is not shy in coming forward. He doesn't disappoint. He methodically works through a number of different scenarios that they had asked him about. So I just wanted to sort of track with Paul, really, and just touch on each of those little scenarios briefly and then draw out two perhaps bigger points to finish roughly about 6 o'clock this evening. So, I'm going to keep motoring. So here's the first question. In verses 1 to 7, he addresses the issue of married couples. Now, it appears there were two diverse views within this little church at Corinth. Both of the views have been picked up from their culture. One view we've already looked at last week, which is that their bodies were actually not that important to God. What God was really interested in was their spirits and their spiritual life. And as long as their spirits and their spiritual life were developing, they could do what they wanted with their bodies, because their bodies were just going to be destroyed when Jesus came back anyway. So why bother? Jesus wasn't that bothered with them, so why should they be bothered? And Paul's already addressed that issue and said, actually, no. Your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. You are destined for resurrection, not destruction. What you do with your bodies is deeply important. That's what we kind of looked at 2 weeks ago. The other view, the flip side of that, was that sex should be avoided. It wasn't something you could just do because God didn't care what you did with your body, just sleep with a prostitute, whatever. It doesn't matter because God doesn't mind. The flip side of that is that actually, no, sex is actually something that's very dirty and something that's very impure and it'll make us unclean. So even within marriage, we need to avoid sex. And Paul writes to them and liberates sex from both of those extreme views. And he says that within marriage, sex is a good and healthy and right thing. And he writes this, I'm just going to give some verses, it's a very long chapter, which you can read later if you're interested, but I'm just going to pick out some verses. He says, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, Paul never led a Church of England wedding service, as far as I'm aware. But if he had done, he would have asked couples to repeat words like, all I am and all I have I give to you. All I have I share with you in the love of God. In a wedding, in a marriage, you give yourself away to the other person, to honor the other person. And that person does the same to you. It's reciprocal. It's balanced. Each does that to the other. And I really love the C of E wedding service because it picks up on so many rich biblical themes, including this one of mutuality within marriage. Because this would have been profoundly shocking. We don't get it because we live where we live in time. But this would have been profoundly shocking to the Corinthians. The shock would have been not the wife does not have authority over her own body. The shock would have been the husband does not have authority over his body, but the wife does. In a patriarchal society, that would actually have made... Hang on, typo! You can't have meant that. It was shockingly liberating to introduce this element of mutuality within marriage. You each belong to the other. Not the male belonging to the wife or the wife belonging to the male, but mutual. And in Paul's first century context of patriarchy and male domination, that was an extremely powerful and radical thing to write and to say. And possibly within our 21st century context of radical individualism, it's also a bit shocking to some of us as well, where even within marriages we can assume that, well, I'm an individual still. Well, then you didn't really mean what you said when you got married. Because when you got married, you gave yourself away to another person. You know, it really annoys me when I go to the bank and I want to know what Mercer's got in her bank account, and they say, well, she'll have to come in and she'll have to come in and check for herself. No, I'm serious. It really annoys me. I say, I'm married to her. She said publicly before God, all I have, I give to you. And all I have, I share with you. I'm not joking. Our culture just doesn't get it. We make these solemn vows before God about giving our lives away to another person. And we receive their life as a gift. And then our culture says, yeah, but you're still an individual. At least you are when you go to the bank. Paul says, within marriage, mutuality. You belong to one another. Sex is good in that context. He then addresses a different category of people. He addresses widowers and widows. In the Bible, it says, to the unmarried. The word unmarried there is a Greek word, agamoi, which commonly in Greek would have been a widower. So in this, again, it's balanced. It's not to the unmarried and the widows, but to the widowers and the widows, I say, it's well to remain unmarried as I am. But if they're not practicing self-control, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. It's interesting that Paul says, as I am. The hint there is that he himself is a widower. You should remain unmarried as I am. He offered the advice to both equally, this mutual thing again. But note this, and we'll pick this up as we come through, and I'll conclude with this as well. Here, as in several of these bits of advice, he says, look, there's a way of wisdom here. The way of wisdom is to stay unmarried. But if there are reasons for you to get married, then get married. In other words, he's not, through all of this, he's not saying, here is what you must do as a Christian. He's saying, look, there's a way of wisdom that I would suggest to you and propose to you. And he has reasons, which we'll come to, why he suggests this. But he also says, but, verse 9, if you're not practicing self-control, in other words, if you really fancy somebody and you want to get married to them, then get married, for goodness sake. Don't burn up with passion. That's nice, balanced advice. There's a way of wisdom, and there's a way of realism, and both are okay with God. I like that. We'll come back to that thought, and we'll see it as we go through. He then addresses Christian married couples, and basically his advice here is, don't get divorced. Here's the actual heart of the teaching. To the married, I give this command, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. Now, some commentators reason, given what else is going on in the letter of Corinthians, that maybe they were getting divorced because they thought that they could live a more pure and devoted life to God. And it's probably that which Paul is addressing here. the issue that, you know, the sex thing is bad and all of that. So I want to get out of this relationship and dedicate myself to God, the kind of monastic kind of thing. And Paul's saying, no, that's not the way it is. And interestingly here, in one of the few places when Paul writes his letters, he appeals to direct teaching of Jesus, because you remember that in Mark's gospel and Luke's gospel, Matthew's gospel, Jesus directly talks about divorce. And Paul says here, listen, I'm picking up on what Jesus said. Not I, but the Lord. I'm passing on to you what he said, which is that basically divorce fundamentally is not something that God wants for married couples. It's too painful, it's too damaging, it's too hurtful. Now, I haven't got time to talk about all of this. There are reasons why I think divorce is legitimate. And I did speak on this a year or two ago, and the podcast is still on the church website under the Sermon on the Mount series. So if you're interested in the nitty-gritty of all of that, I haven't got time to go into it this morning, but it's there for you to follow up. Paul's major concern here is to stop either party initiating divorce for a somewhat spurious reason. And he subscribed to Jesus' view that marriage is intended to be a permanent, faithful, covenant relationship, and that in the gospel there are the grounds for reconciliation and forgiveness and for healing when things go wrong. But note again, he does say, this is what I recommend, this is what Jesus said, but if she does separate, in other words, here's what Jesus wants, but if she does separate, then there's hope still. You don't kick her out. You don't have anything to do with her. As a community, as a church community, you still shelter her under certain conditions which he's put down there. He then moves on to talk about married unbelievers. Now, this is a new situation in the history of the church, because when Jesus did teach about marriage and relationships, he was teaching largely to a Jewish audience, and it was assumed that if you were a Jewish person listening to Jesus, you'd be married to a Jewish person, because a Jewish person married a non-Jewish person was virtually unknown. And so, in fact, it was forbidden. And so Jesus made the assumption that if you are a married person and listening to him, you're married to a believer. But now the gospel's got out into the wider world, suddenly that can no longer be assumed. You may be married, you may have come to faith, and your partner may not have done. Your husband or your wife may not have done. What do you do then? Well, it's interesting, because Paul's assumption in his Jewish background would have been that it would be a right thing to leave, because, in fact, if you have become part of God's holy people, living with someone who's not part of God's holy people would defile you. That was the rationale of the Jewish mindset. That's why the Pharisees, for example, wouldn't walk across a grave, because they believed if you got anywhere too close to anything that was defiled, you would catch that defilement. You would catch that kind of taint in your own character. And so if Paul was relying on his Jewish tradition, he would undoubtedly say, get out of the marriage because you will become unholy. But he doesn't. He says this, to the rest I say, I am not the Lord, meaning, not this is secondary advice, but Jesus didn't address this directly for the reasons I've just said. So I've got to give you some instruction here which we're building on what Jesus said, but Jesus didn't directly address this. So I am not the Lord, that if any believer has a wife who's an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who's an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. And then he adds intriguingly, for the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Just turn to the verse next to you and say what that means. No, don't do that. That's an intriguing statement, isn't it? What does he mean by that? Well, I think what he's doing there is he's picking up on the reversal of the Jewish idea that if you get too close to something that's unclean, you become unclean, which Jesus modeled, the reverse, I mean, Jesus modeled all the time. He went as the Holy Son of God into the presence of tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. And he went there not fearing that I'm going to pick up what they've got. I better be careful. I might become less than the Holy Son of God. No, he went there believing that his character, his personality as the Holy Son of God would somehow transmit something to them that they would find deeply attractive and be drawn to faith. Jesus actually believed that the flow worked the other way around, that holiness was catching. If you live next door to beauty and truth and goodness and generosity and kindness, you'll be drawn into that. It's magnetic. You want more of that. And that's what clearly what Paul doesn't mean is your partner is automatically saved, because he goes on to say, wife, for all you know, you might save your husband. Husband, for all you know, you might save your wife. So he's saying, stay put, be a holy person, radiate the fruit of the Spirit, be full of love and joy and kindness and goodness and gentleness and meekness and kindness and self-control. Show your husband and wife how beautiful it is to be a Christian person. Let them see what holiness looks like. And who knows? They might want to be in on that. To use more modern language, Paul might have said, this becomes now your primary mission field. Live your faith there, responsibly and beautifully, and see what happens. Peter says much the same at the beginning of 1 Peter chapter 3. If you want another version of that, in Peter's letter, he says exactly the same thing. Wives, live with your unbelieving husbands in such a way that they see the beauty of the Lord and want to be drawn into his presence themselves. That's my paraphrase. You have to read it to see exactly what he says. So I think that's amazing advice. And it has wider implications for the church too. Isn't it what we're all called to do every day? As Paul said last week, I'm not writing to you to say get out of the world. I'm saying, no, you've got to be in the world. But be in the world as holy people. I don't mean holy in the sense that it's sometimes used pejoratively, holier than thou, looking down on people, judging people. No, manifesting the character and the beauty of Jesus Christ. Be in the world like that. See if people don't want to see more of the character of Christ in their lives. Generosity, mercy, kindness, grace, faithfulness. Share it around. Live it out. Don't worry about what you're going to catch. Worry about what you're going to impart. C.S. Lewis used to write about contagious Christianity. And he said, if you want to catch a cold, then just sit next to somebody with a cold for a while. Think some things are contagious, and you catch them by being near people. And he said, Christianity is a bit like that. If you want to be contagious, get near somebody that's got it. And who knows, you might catch it too. So that's the advice Paul gives to the married unbelievers. And then for engaged couples, finally, he writes, let me show you the passage again. He says, now concerning virgins. Now, I've got several commentaries on the book of 1 Corinthians on my shelf, and they have a lot of fun with working out who the virgins were, because it's not an easy word to translate. But the most convincing answer is that what he's talking about here, because it makes sense in the flow of the passage and of the word itself, is that Paul's talking about engaged young women, engaged couples. Now, concerning virgins, and incidentally, that makes sense, because he's dealt with virtually every other kind of relationship by now. It's about the only one that's left. Now, concerning virgins or engaged people, I have no command of the Lord. Again, Jesus didn't talk about such things. But I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the impending crisis, it's well for you to remain as you are. And he didn't mean the impending crisis being your marriage. I don't claim to be a Bible scholar, but I do know that much, okay? The impending crisis was that Paul had a strong view that A, the world was going to come to an end soon because Jesus was going to come back, but B, things were going to get worse and worse for Christians. It's going to be tougher and tougher to live in the world as a Christian under the Roman authority and the persecutions that came and so on. Paul said, you'd be much better off without the worry of a husband or wife there. It's one thing for you to suffer. It's another thing for you to watch a wife or a husband suffer. You'd be much better off without children when it comes to that. You don't want to be seeing them taken away. So Paul says, in view of the impending crisis, it's better that you stay single. It's well for you to remain as you are. Are you bound to a wife? In other words, are you engaged, betrothed? Well, don't seek to be free. Okay, well, stay there. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you do not sin. And if a virgin marries, she does not sin. So are you seeing again Paul's balanced advice? He's saying that there's a way of wisdom here. Stay single. But if you marry, that's fine. You're not sinning. All the way through, we're seeing this kind of both and treatment. There's a way of wisdom, but there's a permissive way as well, which is fine. It's not a sin to do that. And Paul's view, as I've said, is one that's better to stay as you are. But notice that the value that Paul places here on singleness. There's a lot of people in this church that are single. And you know, Christianity over the years has probably done a pretty bad job at recognizing the value of being single. We've kind of given the impression, perhaps without meaning to, that the marriage state is the norm, and that one day that's the state that everybody will enter or re-enter. But I don't think the Bible teaches that. I certainly don't think Paul's teaching that here. He's saying that there is a value in a single life. There's a deep challenge in a single life, challenge of loneliness and so on. But there's also benefits in the single life, a freedom and a flexibility to life that you just don't have when you've got concerns for a marriage and a home. And ironically, over the years, I've known many people who are single who have longed to be married. And I've known many people who are married who just long to be single. And that's the truth, and that's not a joke, that's the truth. Because I think there is a risk that we get into a state and we only see the negative side and not the positive side of the state we're in. I'm not saying there isn't a negative side to being single or to being married, but there are positive sides to both. And Paul picks up on those here. He says, it's a hard thing, but maybe you're freer to serve the Lord, maybe you have more flexibility, maybe you have less responsibilities in other areas, so you can focus on different things. And he kind of bigs up singleness in a sense. But note again, he says, if you do, verse 28, stay single, but if you do marry, you don't sin. And I just want to segue into my sort of final couple of reflective thoughts there. Because I've picked up a number of times on how Paul does that all the way through. He says, here's the way, but there's another way, which is okay. And it made me think about how we think about God's will for us, God's plan for us. Some of us see God's will a bit like this. It's a bit of like finding this very difficult, narrow path. And somehow or other, we've got to find out the way that God has planned out our life. And we sort of scramble along this very narrow ridge, hoping that we're not going to fall off one way or the other. Particularly in marriage, you know, I've heard people say, there is one person that God has planned out for me to marry. Undoubtedly true for some. I'm not sure it's true for all. Another way of seeing God's plan, God's will, God's guidance for us is a bit like a completely open space. Dan's turning on at this point in the picture. He's just seeing sleeping under a bit of plastic somewhere over there. Dan's dream. But God's will is like a completely open space. Go where you want, do what you want, live where you want, sleep where you want, with who you want. There's kind of no boundaries at all. And I think both of those are limited, kind of the mountain ridge view, living neurotically in case somehow we missed God's best for us, and the completely no boundaries view. Neither seems to me to be consistent to a full picture of how the Bible describes the way that God guides. I think personally a better image, although strangely it's the lowest resolution image of these three, a better image would be of a beautiful walled garden, where there are boundaries. We talked about some of those last time I spoke, a couple of weeks ago. There are boundaries to our relationships, to our sexuality. There are boundaries, I believe, that Scripture puts in place for our protection. But there's also a big space in the middle within those boundaries to enjoy. Multiple paths we can walk. Multiple things we can, places we can pause and drink and then move on. And I think that view is a liberating and a protecting view both at the same time. It gives us, it removes the anxiety from thinking there is just one path I need to find to tread in our careers, for example, in where we live, not just in marriage terms, but in all terms. How does God guide? I think he says, don't go beyond these boundaries. Within these boundaries, you're within the field of my grace and my love. Listen to my voice. Walk where I'm choosing to call you today. Next week, we might go in a different way. But the issue is not what's the law, but what is Jesus and the Spirit saying to me? So like Jesus, we can say every day, I'm only doing what I see the Father doing, and I'm only saying what I hear the Father saying. There's that responsiveness to the Spirit within the safety of God's overall space, garden. It's kind of the Eden thing. The other final point I wanted to make is a section I missed out right in the middle of the chapter, which is the heart of Paul's teaching throughout this is, I want you to be content where you are. When you came to faith, you were possibly you're married, you might be single, you might be in this work or whatever. You might be in a particular condition of life. I want you to learn to be content where you are. You don't have to believe that you have to be somewhere else to serve God. To use more contemporary language, he might be saying, flourish where you're planted. However that may be, let each of you lead the life that the Lord has assigned to which God called you. This is the rule in all my churches. Let each of you remain in the condition in which you were called. Now, as I've just said, that is not a tightrope thing. Paul's saying there are options for you. But fundamentally, he is saying, I think, and it's good wisdom, that we can always believe the other man's grass or the other woman's grass is greener. We can think that if we just get across the fence, then I'll be free to serve God more fully, or then God will be happy with my life, or whatever. Now, if we're living outside the garden wall, of course, hop over the wall. But if we're within God's wide, gracious will, then let's, wherever we are planted, in that workplace that we're thinking, yeah, but if I could get out, I could really serve God if I was in a different place. I think Paul's challenge to us this morning is to say, can you flourish where you're planted? In the relationship you're in the employment you're in the house you're in the phase of life that you're in. Now, as a very old person, I realize that you spend a lot of your life thinking that one day everything will be different and you're kind of, you know, everything will settle down and suddenly you'll start firing on all six cylinders. And then you get older and you realize that day never comes, you know, and it's kind of, there's this kind of questing for this kind of moment when suddenly it's all going to come together and you can really fire. And actually, I think, you know, that's such a miserable way to spend your life, thinking about the what-ifs and the possibles and if-onlys. And I think what Paul's saying is, if that's where you're at the moment, well, don't shut down the idea that there may be something else that God has for you. But don't be so miserable where you are that you cease to flourish and to serve God where you are. Whether that's in a marriage that's a bit difficult, whether it's as a single person and not being married, whether it's in a marriage with somebody who's not sharing your faith, it may be that there are times, as Paul said, when it's time to move on. But don't live for that moment. Live for this moment. Flourish where you are planted. Remain in the condition in which you were called until God clearly leads you on. So that's 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Some interesting advice to a wide range of people. I don't know if God's spoken to any of us here this morning, but maybe that last point for all of us, it's a wide point. It's not just connected to marriage and sexual relations, it's to do with where we are in life.